people will be joining us as we continue. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lisa Lorraine Smith, the Chief Program Officer here at the network. And I get the honor and pleasure of running affinity groups for our network members. And right now we have 24 affinity groups, but the Holocaust Survivor Services Professionals Affinity Group was the very first one that we had. And that was all because of your original fearless leader, co-chair Laura Gilman, who really wanted to start something like this in the network. So this is not only the first one, but it's also the largest one. There are probably around 220 people in the group. Today we have 97 people who said that, who registered to come. I'm not sure that they'll all show up, but it's a big group. And to that end, I wanted to thank Victoria Pivnik for all of what she did for the past 2 years as co-chair with Laura. Thank you so much for
it's
your-
It's been my pleasure. You guys are all so amazing. And as somebody who used to host the meeting, my anxiety was always the people participation. And everybody in this group is so amazing and so articulate and always has thoughts, ideas, opinions, and we love that so much.
Terrific. So thank you. And now I get the pleasure of introducing, not that she needs much of an introduction, but our new co-chair, Yoni Hoffman from CJ Senior Life. She will be working with Laura and myself to create programming, and they've got lots up their sleeves. So I know that this group is going to continue to thrive, and your input is always important. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Laura and she'll begin, and I'll let everyone in now.
Great, thanks, Lisa. We'll just remind everyone just some housekeeping things. If you can mute your microphone, that would be great. Sometimes static happens all around North America, apparently. We are so grateful to have awesome speakers here with us today. And Yonit and I just really want everyone to know, Victoria and I, Yonit and I, the three of us, the four of us, want everyone to know that we take your feedback very seriously. We know that carving an hour out, 50 minutes out is really hard. We're all in survival mode. We're all doing the best we can. We're all taking care of clients. We're trying to take care of ourselves. So we've got some interactive pieces to this session after we hear from Beit Tzedek so that we can really get a sense of what it is that is important to you and make sure that we incorporate it in our sessions for this coming year. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our two speakers from Beit Tzedek. We have Anna Dar. She's a staff attorney with Beit Tzedek who handles SSI appeals, among other things. I'm thinking it's probably many other things, Anna. And we also have Lisa Hoffman. She's a staff attorney with Beit Tzedek and she handles Holocaust compensation. They'll be giving us a short presentation and then we will probably about 30 minutes, a 30 minute presentation, and then we'll reconvene and get moving on to other topics. Thank you both so much. I'm here if you need any tech help. Really, Lisa is.
Thank you so much. So I'm Lisa Hoffman. As noted, I'm a staff attorney at Beit Tzedek, where I represent Holocaust survivors in reparations claims. And in connection with that, I also sometimes work on issues related to the intersection of reparations and public benefits. So we wanted to do this presentation to share some information with you that might be helpful to your clients who receive SSI. I'm going to talk about some materials that we've created to help survivors protect their public benefits, and in particular, their, sorry about that. Sorry, I'm getting some feedback. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the new supplemental hardship payments from the claims conference and how that might affect SSI. My colleague Anna Dar is going to talk about some issues surrounding the previous and forthcoming economic impact payments. And Kobe Penland, who is our Holocaust Survivor Services, our Holocaust Survivors Justice Network Administrator, is going to just say a few words about what kind of information we're interested in hearing from you as we try to track some of these trends. And of course, at the end, we'll have some time for questions. So as soon as we heard that the claims conference plans to send payments, additional supplemental hardship payments to tens of thousands of Holocaust survivors in the United States, once we finished celebrating that fact, we began to imagine a wave of SSI suspensions and overpayments occurring as a result. Because we know that the Social Security Administration has not a great track record of identifying the source of a payment before they just assume that it is income and resources. Issuing an overpayment or cutting people's benefits as a result. We think that the risk associated with this particular payment from the claims conference is especially high because at least in our experience, most, if not the majority of the eligible applicants in the United States are survivors, mostly from the former Soviet Union, who overwhelmingly depend on SSI as their sole source of income. And many of these people received their initial hardship fund payment, sometimes actually often decades ago, in some cases even before the law was enacted in the United States that makes those payments non-countable for SSI purposes. So they may not be aware that they are allowed to receive these payments and keep them in their bank accounts, even if they're on SSI. As I'm sure most SSI recipients are acutely aware of the maximum balance that they're allowed to have in their account. And the way that they usually respond when they get a reparations payment like this is that they rush to the bank and take all of that money out, all of the extra funds, usually in cash, without realizing that that's actually not enough to prevent Social Security from seeing the payment and counting it as excess income or resources. We know, of course, that many of you have been concerned about this issue as well. So we thought that we would try to do something to hopefully mitigate this problem. One thing that we did that we're very excited about is that we approached the Social Security Administration with the help of our friends at Justice and Aging. We gave them information about this new program, this new payment from the Claims Conference, and Social Security agreed to issue a reminder to all of its field staff that these payments should not be counted or included in income or resources. So we don't yet know exactly what that reminder is going to look like, whether it's going to mention the claims conference by name, if it's going to mention this particular name of this program. But we've been told that that reminder is coming out in the very near future, possibly within the next few days. So in addition to talking to Social Security, yes?
Victoria, you're muted.
Sorry, is this only for California or is this for United States?
This is for the United States. In addition to talking to Social Security, we've developed some materials to educate survivors about their rights and about the fact that they can and should take certain steps to protect their SSI benefits when they receive the hardship payment. Along with that, we wanted to include a tool that survivors can use to actually notify Social Security that they got the payment and that it shouldn't be counted. What we came up with was this two-page fact sheet that incorporates that educational with practical advice about how to get the information to Social Security, especially when all of the field offices are currently closed because of the pandemic. And then the last page of the fact sheet is actually a one-page form that survivors can use where they can fill out some discrete information, their name and social security number, the information about the payment itself, how much it was exactly in dollars, when it was put into their account and so forth, and then send that off to Social Security. Now, these materials are not quite finalized yet because we are hoping to incorporate that information about the new notice or reminder that Social Security is going to issue to its staff, which we're expecting any day now. And we also plan to translate these materials into Russian so that you can have an English version and a Russian version to send to your clients. As I've mentioned earlier, the Social Security field offices are closed to the public right now. And of course, even if they were open, we really wouldn't want survivors to risk their health by going and spending half the day at the Social Security office just to give them some information. And so the fact sheet tells them to submit this form to Social Security by fax or by certified mail. The better way to go is to send it by fax, because all of the Social Security office fax numbers are now e-fax numbers, so that any documents that you submit can then just be distributed electronically to the caseworkers who are working remotely. And of course, items sent by certified mail will work, it will get there, but they go to the offices where they have to be sorted and processed by the sort of skeleton staff that are attending those offices. So it just might not be as efficient. But of course, you know, both options are available depending on the client's resources and, you know, ability to use them. The notice should go to the Social Security office that the client usually uses. And each Social Security office has its own e-fax number and, of course, its own mailing address. So if you would like to use these materials and send them to your clients, and if you have the bandwidth, you can send each client the e-fax number and address of their particular office. Or you can do what some agencies are doing, which is basically just to create a list of all the Social Security offices in your city with their fax numbers and addresses, and then the client can just find their office on the list, since most people are aware of which office they usually go to. Or you can just send them the fact sheet as is. What it does is it just directs people to go to the Social Security website to find the fax number for their office. It's you can either follow this link, or you can just search online for our Social Security office locator, and it will it provides a page where you can enter your zip code, and then it gives you what your office is along with all of its contact information. So as I said, we're still finalizing the materials and the fact sheet itself, but we will have more information for you on it as they are finalized. So we're going to save time at the end, as I said, for questions about this. So for the moment, I'm going to turn it over to Anna Dar so that she can talk about the economic impact payments.
Thank you, Lisa. All right. So yeah, I just wanted to really briefly talk about the stimulus or economic impact payments as they pertain to SSI recipients and cover some basic things that to look out for, and then some options on how to deal with issues should they arise. So first, I think there's more on this slide.
You want me to populate it all?
Sure, you can populate the whole thing. There you go. Thank you. So the first payment, right, went out in April last year. And then the second payment should now have been completed, all of it. It was either sent as direct deposits, or for people who didn't have that set up as prepaid debit cards back in January. It was supposed to all be sent out by Friday, January 15th. In this round, you know, payments were $600 for individuals or $1,200 for married couples, another $600 for each child under the age of 17. And then in general, everyone who received a payment in the first round should have automatically received the second one, including everybody on SSI. And anyone who missed deadlines to register for payments or had other issues receiving the payments should be able to claim it in the form of a refundable tax credit when they file their tax return for 2020 this year. And then on the third payment, last I checked, and of course things change all the time, but last I checked, it looks likely, right? It's moving through reconciliation in Congress now, and it's supposed to be, as of now, $1,400 for single, $2,800 for couples. Next slide. Thank you. So a very important point here for those folks who are receiving SSI in particular. Because these payments are like tax refunds, the funds are not counted as income or as a resource for SSI eligibility or for any needs-based government benefits eligibility for a period of 12 months from the date of receipt. So what does that mean? Well, if you receive SSI, right, you can't have more than $2,000 in your bank account as an individual or $3,000 for a couple, like Lisa just talked a little bit about. If you do, then you're no longer eligible for SSI. So if you were over that limit for 1 month or 2 months in the past and the Social Security Administration finds out, which they will do, as Lisa says, it doesn't help that you just take money out of your account. They check your balances automatically, right? So if you went over, that means they'll want their payment back because you were not eligible. So if we say client Michael, he gets $954 in SSI every month. Say he accidentally had $2,100 in his account in November, $2,050 in December, then he'll be can be charged with an overpayment of $1,908, 2 months worth of his SSI benefit, right? If he does nothing when he receives this overpayment, then in a couple of months, he'll notice that his monthly payment is being reduced by 10%. Until he's paid all that money back. So that means he would get $859 a month for the next 20 months to pay that payment back, which is obviously not a good situation. However, for the economic impact payment, if Michael saved $1,000 of that first stimulus check in his bank account and he didn't spend it, he just left it in there, then even if his bank account was at $2,500, $2,800, $2,999, he would not be over the limit because that $1,000 would not be countable. The Social Security Administration did issue an emergency message with instructions for their workers on how to treat this EIP payment for SSI purposes. And I think that's already been shared with this whole group, but if not, let me know and we can share it again. But of course, and this was issued for the first round of economic impact payments, but it's also being, it also covers the second payment and whatever, if the third payment happens. I do want to flag, though, that we're coming up now, right, on the end of that 12-month period. If you got your first payment back in April, then you might want to make sure that your account, that you actually spend that before April hits again, because then it'll be counted. And then more on the 12-month rule, right? We've seen a few clients who do receive SSI across the country who kept their first payment in their bank account for a lot of months, and then they still receive, they receive an overpayment notice. And SSI, Social Security was actually counting the money they had in their account. This process, this is obviously erroneous, right? But this is what it looks like for a client. They would first get a notice from Social Security, and normally it would be titled either notice of change in payment or notice of overpayment. And that notice then outlines all the months that the person was alleged to be over resources and by how much. It's very clear, even though it's usually a lot of pages, so it looks confusing and overwhelming, but it's when you look at it, it does outline exactly which months and by how much and which bank account. So that first notice is usually followed very shortly by an actual notice of overpayment, providing the total that you were overpaid. And then they also, on the notice of overpayment, just important to flag, they usually include this horrible little payment stub where you can just, you have the option to pay back your overpayment by credit card or check. And sometimes these are for like $20,000, which just freaks people out completely. And how, really, to an SSI recipient, you're asking for 20K back. But anyway, that's a side note. So if your client gets one of these, right, notice of change in payment because they were over because of their impact payment, the first thing to look at if this happens, first you have to figure out if it's actually wrong. Because for the money to be non-countable, it has to actually stay in the account the entire time. So again, going back to Michael, right? If he received his $1,200 payment in April, and then he spent his account down to $10 in June, so he spent it all except for $10, and then he started saving up again, then if he had $2,100 in his account in November and December, that's counted, because that's not the impact payment. He already spent that. He only had $10 left. So you have to look at all the bank statements from the date they got the impact payment to the overpayment charge to make sure that this is actually the impact payment. Because just because you got a payment back in April, it doesn't mean you can be $1,000 over this whole time. It has to be the actual money. You have to be able to trace that, the funds, right? So if it is an erroneous notice, if Michael's account never did dip below $1,000, meaning he did save the stimulus money the entire time. The notice from Social Security always outlines what to do to appeal. So to avoid the 10% recoupment starting, what I mentioned before, they start taking 10% in 2 months. You need to avoid that to just happen automatically. You just need to respond to the notice within 30 days. If you don't respond within 30 days, they will automatically begin the recoupment, but you still have 60 days to file your appeal and it'll still be timely. And if they've already started recouping, they'll stop once they receive your appeal. So if you file it between day 31 and day 60, then it just stops again the month the appeal is filed and they'll stop pending the outcome. And then, you know, if you are successful, obviously they'll pay back whatever they recouped and not take any more. But if you're not, then they'll start the recoupment again. And that 60-day deadline, that can be extended for good cause, but obviously it's always better to file timely. I want to just make sure it's clear that filing an appeal, it sounds like it's this overwhelming process, right? But it's really not. It's just a form. And it's usually listed by name in the notice you get from Social Security, but it's called the SSA 561 form. And there's going to be a picture on the next slide. We don't have to go through it yet, but I'll show you what it looks like. And you can Google it and get a PDF version. It's really simple. Technically, you don't even have to use that form. I always do. I think it's easier to just kind of speak their language and use their own documents. But technically, you can send in a letter that just says, I'm appealing this. But, you know, it's always good to use their own language. So in the case of an erroneously counted impact payment, if Michael really did save that money and now he's being charged with an overpayment, then your client should really only need to send in, and I say should because you never know with Social Security, but you should only need to send in that form, the 561, and then bank statements showing that the money was in there the whole time. And then it's also good to send in a copy of their own emergency message, reminding them that they're not supposed to count the money, right? If it's been longer than 60 days, you can certainly, you know, try to argue good cause for why you took so long, but you could also just file a waiver. There's no time limit for a waiver. And that also would stop the recoupment once it's been filed, pending the outcome. The difference between the two is technical. Technically, a waiver is seeking forgiveness for the overpayment, just saying, please don't make me pay this back. It wouldn't really be fair. And it wasn't my fault. Whereas an appeal or the request for reconsideration form, you know, really says you were wrong in charging this in the first place. The overpayment waiver is also a standard form and you can attach whatever exhibits you need to. It's called the SSA 632. Whichever approach you take, we always advise that you send it in a way that you can prove that they received it. Kind of what Lisa just talked about, faxed it, certified mail. We've heard of so many more cases than we can count where documents just kind of disappear when you send them into Social Security. I'm sure you're all familiar. People file appeals, you know, call weeks later to follow up and then they're told, oh, we didn't get anything. And if you have no evidence that you actually sent it in, then, you know, you can find yourself in quite a bind. Finally, the notices and the approach, like what this all looks like and how you respond to it would be really similar if it's your client's reparations payments that are being erroneously counted. You know, you would still need to file an appeal or a waiver, provide bank statements and documentation showing where the funds came from, that the reparations. That's a different presentation, but we have a fact sheet at BetCedic that we always provide outlining the law and reparations payments not being counted as income or assets that we also would include with those. And then next slide, I just put in images of a sample notice. There it is. You know, you'll see here notice of change in payment. And then it just says you were over resources for these months. And then it tells you this is how much you were paid for that month. And you should have been paid zero. So that's why you owe us all the money back. And then on the second form here is the request for reconsideration appeal form. You see, it's very simple, right? You can write one sentence if that's all you need, and you can also attach. And yeah, we can certainly share the form and the links to the forms for resource library purposes. And they're really easy to find on Social Security's website as well. And that's all I had. Sorry, that was a lot of information very fast, but happy to, you know, follow up with people individually afterwards if it's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna. That is so helpful. Lisa, Kobe?
Yeah, Kobe had a couple of notes to make. Is Kobe on with us?
I'm not even sure Kobe is on this call. I'm looking.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, just a note to, you know, we are interested in knowing if people are seeing any of these problems happening. For example, if it looks like people are getting the hardship fund, you know, supplemental payment, and then they're having a problem with Social Security or with their SSI as a result. And likewise, if we're seeing a lot of issues with it concerning the economic impact payment. So if you do have clients who are having that happen, you can reach out to any of us, but Kobe would probably be the first one to reach out to as our Holocaust Survivors Justice Network administrator. You know, the HSJN, Holocaust Survivors Justice Network, is our national network where we, you know, try and, you know, keep track of various trends, and then we provide various legal services to survivors in a number of different cities. So we have, there are email addresses here is basically our first initial last name at betsedic.org. So that's really easy.
Okay.
So are there any questions that we can answer? I was just looking at the chat a little bit. We are going to provide all of these materials once they're all ready. And so I hope that we can, you know, just ask you guys to help distribute them for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One question.
Yes, Yonit, please.
I think we separately emailed you, Lisa, about it, and I'm not sure exactly how to articulate it, except that it had to do with a survivor who was actually in a nursing home, who was concerned about getting the payment and that having be put into sort of a Medicaid spend down pot. You know, that this is in, again, they were considering it as income. They shouldn't be. We provided the letter that we have, and they're still sort of holding off and researching it. So I'm just wondering if that has happened with other situations or other payments with regard to that kind of situation where they're in a skilled nursing facility and Medicaid is requiring that they spend down all of their income before they can provide a, you know, a bed.
Yeah, I mean, as we were talking about yesterday, I think that the, you know, because the Medicaid eligibility rules are slightly different, you know, sometimes in certain states, sometimes that can get in the way a little bit where you're not, in some places, you're not automatically eligible just because you are eligible for SSI. But I don't know, Anna, do you have any suggestions for people who are having trouble convincing their nursing home that the payment shouldn't be counted under Medicaid?
I haven't really run into that issue much. I mean, I think it's just about talking to the administrator of the nursing facility and you know, showing them documentation. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward issue. I think it's just about, you know, sharing the correct information.
We did, and we will continue to. And we thank you for the things that we did share, because we use your materials often.
Right.
Thank you so much, Lisa and Anna. And Kobe, I saw that you hopped on. If you just want to put, we're going to share these slides with everyone, but if you want to put your email address in the chat, we will share with you if we have experiences where supplemental hardship payments are cramping people's style with getting their SSI benefits. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Kobe. Thank you so much. Does anyone else have last questions? Otherwise, we'll move forward and thank our friends from BateSedic for showing up. Thank you. Send some sunshine to us, please. Please.
Any I know sunshine? We have plenty. I'm so sorry.
Send it over. We're all vitamin D deficient if we're not in a warm place. There aren't that many. Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Kobe. Thank you. So we are going to move on. We're going to move on to a survey, and we're going to ask you to take a couple of minutes to fill it out while we're together. Lisa just put it in the chat. We're going to ask you to take a few minutes to fill it out. And then after this, we will do a poll that is interactive so we can talk through what the rest of the year is going to look like, because we want this to be meaningful time for everyone. So go ahead and click that survey.
It's very exciting that we learned how to do this 1 year in.
The poll is even more exciting, but this is exciting too.
So explain why we're doing the survey.
So we're doing the survey because we want to make sure we are now able to use breakout rooms, and we want to make sure that we're using this time to discuss issues that are important to you. So the survey asks about your community, the types of survivors that you're serving, and we are going to be able to use our sessions to group agencies that have similar needs, similar populations that they're serving, similar challenges that they want to talk through together. So take a couple minutes and then we will get back together for the poll. Thanks again, Beit Tzedek. We really appreciate you guys sharing.
And in
sharing.
The survey, we talked about the mentoring and monitoring.
That's right, right. We have opportunities to mentor and or be mentored. We call it Chavruta learning because it's really about being a thought partner with another agency. Sorry, my mom just said the baby's sleeping, so I'll keep my voice quiet. I know we're all struggling with this work-life balance. So take a look at the survey and we'll get back in like 3 minutes.
No, I think everyone should fill out the survey. If there's more than one, that's okay.
Yeah, and I think we'll also send it out afterward because I know not everybody who belongs to the affinity group is here or necessarily can do it right now. So we will send it as well.
Can I ask what an HSSPAG is?
The Holocaust Survivor Services Professionals Affinity Group. HSS, instead of writing it out, I'm trying to shorten it.
If you ask us.
Yes.
Lots of letters.
And the reason we wanted to do the survey right now is because a lot of times you send out a survey, not everyone necessarily responds. But if we have 52 people on the call, hopefully we'll have at least 52 answers, which will be great.
When you're done with the survey, you can give us a reaction. Like you could just do this with your real hands. You could do a thumbs up or a smiley face or a party, whatever you'd like. And we'll know to circle back.
Now you're getting fancy.
I know, I asked Victoria, how does one blur the background like that? I love it.
Because there is a child studying right behind me.
So whoever just came in to our call, we have a survey on the right-hand side, which you can do. It's from me, from Lisa, to everyone, that link. So are people almost done with that? Need a little more time?
I see you, Howard.
Nodding of the head, some sort of, okay, we're all done. Terrific, let's move forward.
Up. Okay, great.
All right,
I'm gonna pass it over to Yonit, thanks.
So now that we use our survey skills, we're going to do a poll. I think really appreciate about the affinity group, that long acronym, is the affinity part of it and just seeing each other and networking. But we also know there's lots of shared challenges and shared issues. And so we took some of your feedback from the end of the year survey and we thought about other issues that we've experienced and we've heard about and put together kind of a list of potential topics for our group. We took 10 sort of major topics that we will run through. I can kind of run through them just to share with you some of the ideas that we had. And then we thought you could choose your top five so that we can kind of cull and narrow down what would be of most interest to all of us when we come together for these groups. So I think it's up there right now, correct?
Yes, can't you see it?
Yeah, I see it. I just have so many screens open, I wasn't seeing where it was. So we started with just what's been on our minds very, very timely right now with COVID vaccination issues and talking maybe about how do we provide guidance from a PCTI perspective? What kind of trust and access issues are we experiencing? The tips just on navigating this complex system, which we know varies widely between states and between cities, but maybe we can help each other with some of that. And even side effects for older adults and whether or not we're hearing about any of that from vaccinations. That was one issue that seemed most timely. And then continuing just with COVID things, we're seeing, I know in our program, some underreporting sometimes of COVID because of feelings of shame or embarrassment, or that somehow they did something wrong, or our survivors feeling very independent and not wanting to acknowledge that they need help. So we just thought that might be something of interest to talk about from a trauma-informed perspective, cultural issues, and then how do we assess risk when we think somebody is sick or they haven't told their caregiver or their children, and what is our duty to inform, and what do we do with that? Another completely different topic is about just financial assistance to survivors and the different ways that our programs approach those. So do we look at equity so that we're providing assistance for everyone in the same way? Sometimes we know that that is actually culturally sometimes important to our FSU survivors, that there's this collective kind of sense of it should be fair. Or do we look at individual needs, or do we balance both and have some sort of triage models? Are there different ways that we distribute funds, and how do we handle wait lists and messaging about waiting lists? So those are some issues around financial assistance that we thought might be interesting to talk together about. Another one is just about what we're doing right now, how to virtually engage not only each other and other colleagues, but our clients, our staff. It's getting old here on Zoom. And there's a lot of Zoombies and Zoom fatigue. So just to find ways that don't feel too gamey or artificial or kind of off-putting, but are engaging. So we would love to hear ideas about that. The topic of boundaries in our program comes up quite often. It certainly came up more when we were seeing people face-to-face, where we were offered a lot of gifts. But we still have issues like that. One of our care managers was offered kind of a bribe to help with something. So just using ourselves, boundaries about how we disclose, even now we're all sharing the pandemic together and we're having experiences about that, and we get a lot of questions. So how do we use ourselves in a way that's helpful, and how do we kind of avoid certain boundary worries? Another topic was about volunteers. We all use them to some degree. What are our best practices? How do we train them? How do we acknowledge them? How do we retain them? FSU survivors, of course, for those as part of our asking the survey in terms of looking at breakout groups for those who are serving more survivors from the FSU, what kind of cultural issues are we facing? What kind of biases in our community are we addressing? Which I know we try very hard to do a lot of education around our FSU survivors and their experiences. How do we deal with their feelings about counseling or about clinical intervention that may be different from our other survivor populations? End of life issues, we've had some great speakers on that before, but it's always something that we're thinking of, unfortunately, as we continue to face those end of life experiences for our survivors. And I know that we've had some discussions with Beth Sadek too about advanced directives, which have been helpful. And other ways that we can provide support to our survivors and their families and their caregivers. Use of evidence-based programs. So there's a lot of push from funders and from grants to use evidence-based programs. And sometimes those aren't necessarily the right kind of programs for our survivors. So how do we balance that? Do we adapt those evidence-based programs to deal with emergent issues from a PCTI approach or for a cultural approach, but then do we lose fidelity to those programs? So that would be another idea. And then finally, with next generation, what kind of services are we providing as agencies to 2Gs and 3Gs? And if we are, how are we funding it? How are we staffing it? What ideas do we have? I mean, we certainly do a lot of work with families, but we don't necessarily provide specific services for 2Gs and 3Gs. So those were some of our few ideas, and we hope that you've been able to choose your top five. We're certainly welcome for other ideas as well. So you can either put into the chat other ideas that you have, or we will email this as well. So that you can, if you want to rank them, we couldn't get that fancy and have them like choose five and rank them. So if we send you an email and you say, I really want these top three, then we can try to incorporate that into our planning and leave time for talking with each other and just seeing each other. So any thoughts, first of all, about those topics? Anything resonate with anyone, or did you think of some that we really glaringly missed?
Well, I know you talked about the former Soviet Union survivors, but in Montreal, we have a lot of Moroccan Sephardic survivors. I don't know if you have in the States, if that's an issue there, but obviously there's different cultural issues as well. And besides language, we speak Quebec, so it's easier for us for sure. There's that cultural difference as well that we're still, we have challenges in Montreal because a lot of Sephardic communities, clients don't come to us because they have their own community resources or they just don't want. So it's a challenge to reach out to them.
So what's great about that initial survey, where we said we wanted to understand what your community of survivors looks like, is that maybe we can match you with other agencies who are working with that population. And
yeah,
I think we can also learn from each other. We
absolutely
have that population are really interested in hearing what issues you're facing and what kind of commonalities and differences there are.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's great.
The financial issue really is a big one for me. We do have, our claims conference line items. We do have a partnership with Kavod. We do have some internal financial assistance, but there's a lot of demand constantly for different things and trying to navigate what's worthy, quote unquote, of spending money and how much. Is there like a number across the board we give to people, a maximum? It makes it very difficult because once one person hears about it and everyone expects that's the amount I'm going to get. And obviously throughout the year, the amount of money available changes as things happen. So it's really, for me, as the administrator of the program, quite a challenge to try and balance the conflicting needs and stay on budget and meet the needs also at the same time. That's the number one goal, but try and do it in a fiscally sound way, in a way that is sustainable.
It is a huge issue for sure. And we could probably do a month just on
exactly.
But I think that if this would be a great place to at least to start to talk about it and then maybe develop some kind of off the affinity group connections or ways to talk about specifics. So again, looking at what programs are similar, like what volume are you talking about? What kind of assistance does your program provide versus someone else's? And how can we find some commonalities? Because it is the top issue in my mind. It keeps me up at night. So it's definitely something that I would love to hear how other people are managing it.
That's something potentially that could be a pop-up, right? We have in the survey, it talked about pop-ups that happen outside of the affinity group calls. And potentially that could be one, or even the one that Nancy talked about, could be a pop-up working with difficult communities. I'm sorry, someone else was going to talk.
I also would like to really talk about how we communicate with our survivors during this pandemic. Zoom is not always accessible to our survivors. They don't know how to really use the computer. If I don't have an aide in there that can help with that, some of them don't have computers at all. What technology is out there that we really can get into the homes of our survivors? And where does that money come from to pay for that technology?
Sounds like that technology is what's called a telephone.
But the telephone is not always accessible for some of our survivors because they're hearing impaired. They're actually much older, and it becomes a big problem in communication.
Yeah.
So what was that software that they talked about at the conference in Atlanta where they have them in on your TV?
Is that Uniper?
Yeah, Uniper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Los Angeles was doing that, right? Right.
I think that CJ
Uniper, they were offering some subsidies and things like that, but it is a monthly charge.
Right. Yeah.
And there will be, by the way, I haven't gotten to the save the dates yet, which we will in a minute, but there will be a presentation about UNIPER at the NJHSA conference in April too. But we're definitely all struggling with how to have our survivors connect with us, recognizing that it's requiring multimodality kind of approach, and none of them seem to be perfect or a replacement, you know, for face-to-face. So I think we've had, there've been some discussion about those kinds of things, but I, you know, obviously we still need help with that. So it's a good topic.
Yeah, I think maybe we could also talk about like all different types of programs. We have developed a huge virtual program at the Cumming Center that is available. It's online. It's anybody can reach it. It's not just for Montreal community. So maybe sharing what other communities have that we can have seniors join in on, all the different types of programming that's available, instead of, you know, duplicating and triplicating all over everybody, every agency creating something for their community.
Right.
Could be shared.
Right. I mean, that's one of the silver linings of all of this, is that it's virtual, we can share it. Logistically, sometimes it's complicated. Russian language or other languages, you know, certainly we have fewer programs available to our older adults and our survivors in particular. So sharing those resources with each other is really helpful.
And I put in the chat how you actually get into the resource library, and I encourage you all to cut and paste that, put it on a Word document, cut it out, put it somewhere so that you always have that.
Right.
Laura, do you want me to end the polling now? And should we share this?
Sure, Lisa, yeah, we can.
Has everyone voted? Has everyone put in their information that they're, does that even make sense? Has everyone?
Anyone need another minute? Yeah.
Okay, and share.
82%, not bad.
Interesting. Clearly, how to virtually engage clients, staff, and colleagues on Zoom or other platforms with creative engagement ideas that are useful, interesting, but not too gamey or artificial. Okay.
That was my bias, I think. Sometimes I'm not good at those gamey things. This is really helpful, though. Thank you all for participating, so that we can really kind of focus on the things that most people want.
Yep. Terrific. Okay. So Yonit, before we end, did you want to talk about the intimate gatherings and the conference?
Sure. I don't think Jenny's on. Is she? I don't think she is. Jenny Frumer, who I know is one of the leaders of the intimate gatherings, where, and I'm going to read what she wrote, where it's a space to breathe and share and sustain your practice. And it's, I think, up to 15 people who can come in on it. There's one on March 9th and March 10th. And Jenny, as I said, leads it and can answer, ask any questions. I don't think that you have to participate in every single one. And I think it can be different people. It's open and open-ended, and a nice kind of other, more intimate kind of opportunity to share some of our challenges. So that's on March 9th and 10th. And can I go ahead and share other dates then as well?
Well, I was just going to say about this is that it's really a group to, when she says share our challenges, I think that what Yonit and Jenny is talking about is to share our own personal challenges. It's more of a group to find support within each other, with each other, so that we can take care of ourselves, so that we're strong enough to take care of, you know, the people that we, you know, our clients. And some of you have been on the last intimate gatherings. And I know I was on one. It was extremely well done. I felt very supported. It was fantastic, really. And, you know, I've been running groups for years and I was like, oh, I want to go back. So I encourage you, if that's something that you're interested in, if you want to, you know, share your thoughts and feelings about being in this field and working with Holocaust survivors with your colleagues, that's a good place to do it. And it's small.
Where's Lisa, where's the link for that?
The link for that hasn't come yet because I have to send it out to everyone. And then we can only take the first 15 people for each. You know, I'm just saying that that's the way it is because we don't want to have it to be so large that people can't share and talk because, of course, it's only an hour and actually 50 minutes. And I think when I was in it, she did some breathing. We were, I don't know, I can't even remember. It was so good. I don't know if any of you were involved in any of these, but I left that 50 minutes feeling so relaxed. Like I wanted to go downstairs and make dinner happily. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't always happen. So I can say from my own experience that it was good. What?
And it did not involve alcohol. I don't.
And it did not involve alcohol. Amy, were you on one? Were you going to say something, Amy Newman? Mm-hmm. Anand.
No, I was on one. It was great.
So were there usually 15, the full 15 people, or was it smaller, more intimate?
Mine only had around 7, I think, when I went, you know, 7 or 8.
Fabulous. I highly recommend it to anybody who didn't have the opportunity to join, or if you have staff that didn't have the opportunity, it really was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Thank you for making it available to all of us. Thank you.
Yeah, we just want to acknowledge it's like there's so many technical things that we're working on with our clients. And we just want to acknowledge that we're all people and we're all going through this very hard, difficult, challenging time. So humanity. I think it's like a good reminder. All of our humanity is connected. And Jenny is amazing. She's a longtime JFCSer maybe. So if anyone doesn't know her, she's just an awesome clinician, leader, mentor. So we're just so lucky. She came to us and said, like, I want to do this. And so we're just really lucky to have her. And I would encourage you to opt in if it sounds meaningful.
Terrific. And
great. I'm sold. You're very good ambassadors. And I think that, you know, self-care could be a whole topic too, just in terms of another topic and how we do balance that. How we manage to take care of ourselves so that we can help our survivors and all of that. So you'll send the link for that, Lisa.
I'll send the invitation.
And I would say,
Thing to talk about, if you want to, is the annual conference.
Well, I can, or you can, because you're much more connected to the...
Am I ever. So since it's my baby and it's a big one, oh my goodness, because it's virtual and it's new and we're doing 6 program showcases, of which one is a Holocaust Survivor Services, a professionals affinity group program showcase, really. So I encourage you all to come if you don't know about it. Hopefully you're all on our Friday distribution list and you get the newsletter. And if you don't get it, then I want you to email me so we make sure we put you on that list. Anyway, if your agencies can afford to send you, that would be great. It's a relatively inexpensive ticket. A lot of your agencies are getting the unlimited ticket, which means that as many staff that want to attend can attend. So follow up and find out, because there'll be some good opportunities for you to learn and connect and be with each other. So I hope to see you all there. And that's April 19th to the 22nd.
Is there an agenda available yet?
Not yet, but there will be on Monday or Tuesday, because we're partnering with another organization that hasn't gotten their schedule completed yet. And we want to send it out together, but we have all of our RFPs chosen, right, for the workshops. Our plenaries are set. And the really exciting is we got the Voices of the City Choir. Did anyone see America's Got Talent? Anyway, they didn't win. They were the runners up. And they're a choir from San Diego that was founded by a woman who saw all these homeless people in her community and felt like, you know, she could really work with them and teach them a skill. And they've become this choir that is now traveling around. They're ambassadors for other, you know, homeless people. They're building different kinds of communities like this. They provided housing and jobs, and not only, you know, the teamwork of being in a choir. So They're called Voices of the City, and they're coming to us, and they're doing a special, you know, performance for us. So we're very excited about that.
Sounds really cool. And I have a question for you, Lisa. We decided not to do an affinity group that month because we were hoping to have an opportunity to maybe gather during that conference. I don't know if there will be opportunities for little virtual, I don't know, even lunch groups or something.
Well, yes and no, because there isn't as much time to have every affinity group have their own time to gather like that. But I'll take that under advisement, and maybe we can figure out a way to make this happen for the group. But I know we're having our program showcase. We're having lounges Tuesday night, which are really going to be fun. And we're dividing people up. You're choosing where you want to go, depending on the kinds of things you like. So there'll be, you know, guilty pleasures, you know, if you're a book lover or animal lover, or I'm not even sure, all sorts of different things. We're doing so much. It's all blending into one, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be different. It's going to be virtual. We're going to be giving out gift cards, right? We have this thing called gamification. If you upload your photo, you get 10 points. Who knows? Every day we're giving away $300 gift cards. Hopefully people will get involved. It's going to be fun. That's all I got to say. We have a month and a week to get it all together.
Good luck.
Thank you. But I hope to see you there.
We know you.
Oh, we'll be there.
Right.
All right. And then I think we're pretty much good on time. We have then other affinity groups scheduled for June, August, October, and December. So we'll send those dates out to everybody again. And then you get a Zoom invitation, I believe, or a calendar invitation a couple weeks before each of them, and reminders as well. But I know I like to have them all sort of at once. So maybe we can remind you about those dates when we send an email to you to follow up with some things.
Terrific. We'll do.
And if in the survey you said that you would like a mentor or would like to mentor, we'll reach out to you individually and make a match so that we can get people connected to thought partners that they can call and just say, like, I'm super confused. Like, Lisa Hoffman, we're all going to want to be thought partners with you and Anna. Like, hey, I got an SSI problem all the time, all day, every day.
Okay. You asked, when someone asked about the program showcase time slot, and that is, I thought maybe Tuesday afternoon. Yes, it depends where you are. I think 3:45 to 4:45 Eastern. I could be wrong. Don't quote me. I don't know. You'll get it in the I can't even read that. You'll get it in the mail. I'm gonna edit that out so Ruben, you know, the boss, doesn't hear me say I don't know when it is or what time it is. Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Have a great day, everyone.
Stay well.
Thank you,
well.
Yoni and Laura. You did good.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody, for organizing. This was great.
We're trying.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.